Hello, everybody. Warm welcome to the fourth and final day of 100 Years of Beat. We are going to start the discourse program now with a talk by Freddie Williams Evans. Freddie Williams Evans is an independent scholar and author of several prize-winning books, among them Congo Square, African Roots in New Orleans, which is exactly what she's going to talk about now here to you all. Two announcements. After her talk, there's the possibility of asking questions. And another thing is that not only Freddie Williams' books, but also books of the other participants of the panels are available in our bookstore. So now, a very warm welcome to Freddie Williams Evans and the lecture, Congo Square, African Culture in New Orleans.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Detlef for that warm welcome. I'd also like to thank Gabriella, Lena, Pia, and Lana for their hospitality and actually for the invitation to come to this occasion. This is really an honor for me. I always like to talk about Congo Square because that's really been my research over 20 years now, probably 25 years off and on. So tonight, or this afternoon, I wanted to talk about the place, since we're in a setting that you may not be familiar with, Congo Square. And I wanted to talk about the people, their practices, and the influence of their practices. Congo Square, of course, is located in New Orleans. And this is an early map of New Orleans. This shows the Mississippi River. It shows Jackson Square, which is the main square of town. And in the back is the area that would become Congo Square. We know that before the founding of New Orleans, this area was populated by Native Americans who actually camped in this area. So a lot of archaeological digs show that the area that is now called the French Quarter was really a Native American city or a camping site. Then when we look at the Spanish period, we see, again, the Mississippi River. We see the plaza. And in the center of the plaza is a cross, which represents our church, which is St. Louis Cathedral. On either side would be the museums. One is the Cabildo, and on the other side is the Presbyterian. And now, during the Spanish period, the city has developed a little bit more. It's opened up. And we can see that exactly six blocks behind Jackson Square is the square that would become Congo Square. During the Spanish period, it's called Fort Ferdinand. But then you see the development that has happened. We see the Claude Treme concession, which becomes Treme neighborhood. You may have heard of the series Treme, which was a very popular television series a couple of years ago. So this is the Spanish period. Let's look now at the American period, what has happened to the city. We see the name Congo Square on the map. So over the years, Congo Square, and this is in 1885, way into the American period, which began in 1803 with the Louisiana Purchase. So Congo Square over the years held many, many names. Some were official, but most were not official. Congo Square has never been an official name until 2011, until my first book, Congo Square, African Roots in New Orleans, was released. So in 1893, the square received one official name, which was Beauregard Square. It was named after a Confederate general. And then for 118 years, it held that name until 2011. So although people around the world knew it as Congo Square, I even saw a program that Gabriella just gave to me where there was a conference here entitled Congo Square in 2004, I believe it was. So at that point, it was not the official name of the location, but it was a name that people around the world knew. And it was the name that most people in New Orleans knew. When I approached the city council, they didn't even know that it was not officially Congo Square. So here is the archway that leads into the area that houses Congo Square. It's now located within Louis Armstrong Park, which is on Rampart Street. So if you were to go into the park, enter this way through the archway, if you turn left, you would then see the site that is now Congo Square, the paving stones. We have
on the site, though, the Municipal Auditorium, which was built there in 1930. So the Municipal Auditorium takes up one half of the space of what is now Congo Square. One of the travelers who wrote about Congo Square in the 1820s said that the Congo Square consisted of 5 to 6 acres of land. Now we know that the Municipal Auditorium sits on approximately 3 acres, so we have about 2.2 something acres of land left to that houses now or consists of what we call Congo Square. This is a historical marker that was placed there, the first one in 1997. So 20 years later, last year, 2017, the City Council refurbished it for us, and now it's in red. Before it was in brown. And these are the paving stones that were placed in 1980 during the renovation phase when Louis Armstrong Park came into being. I'm not sure what happened here. Let's go back. Sorry about that. Okay, so when Louis Armstrong Park was converted into a park from the demolition of houses, actually 9 blocks of residential area was torn down in the area in that space. And was not to make Louis Armstrong Park. That was not the initial intent, but it ended up becoming a park. And Congo Square, being adjacent to it, was also refurbished and then brought back into the fray, so to speak, brought back into the setting. And it then resumed the name Congo Square in the 1980s, full force. Everybody considered it Congo Square, although it was not legally or by law officially Congo Square. Okay, let's go on. Let's talk about the people. Because without the people who gather there on Sunday afternoons, Congo Square would be just any other public space in New Orleans. But it was the enslaved Africans who were able to gather there indirectly because of what's called the Code Noir, which stands for Black Codes. Those codes were adopted by officials in Louisiana in 1724. And one of them said that Sundays were to be holy days, to be observed as holy days, so that there would be church services in the morning. And it said also that Sundays would be work-free days for all inhabitants of the colony. That included enslaved people by default. So indirectly, they received the day off. Some people say it was their free day. Of course, we know that they were not free, but they had liberty that they did not have on the other days, and that is, of course, with their owner's permission. Because without their owner's permission, their free day would have been void, actually. So on Sunday afternoons, they were able to congregate for recreational purposes, and they did this at other locations in the city until 1817. And that year, the city council, and they had done so over the years, revisited the opportunity for enslaved people to come together. And in that year, 1817, the city council proposed to the mayor to restrict the gatherings, name certain locations where enslaved people were together. In 1812, just 5 years before that, the mayor had allocated 3 locations for enslaved people. And in 1817, 5 years later, there was 1 location. We can't find the actual document that says there's 1 location, but we know all of the evidence, all of the newspaper articles, the travelers' accounts, all of the documents point to 1 location, and that sole location was Congo Square. Now, who gathered in Congo Square? We know that enslaved people who had been born in Africa gathered there. And that was during the transatlantic slave trade. New Orleans was founded in 1718. We're celebrating our 300-year anniversary this year. And so this is a great time to come to New Orleans if you have ever thought about that, if you have plans to travel someplace. And so in 1718, the order was put in to bring enslaved Africans to help build the city. Those first ships arrived in Louisiana in 1719. That transatlantic slave trade lasted until 1803, when the U.S. Congress banned. Banned the slave trade, the international slave trade. So we know in Louisiana that did not end the international slave trade, because we know that ships were brought in through the bayous, through the backwaters, through the swamp lands, into Louisiana, into the 1840s, we have newspaper articles that say, and actual documents that say that the that ships bringing enslaved people still entered the coastal areas of Louisiana. And then in 1808, the rise of the domestic slave trade happened, so that then people were coming in, were being brought in, enslaved people from within the United States, from Virginia, from Maryland, from North Carolina. That is called the domestic slave trade. So when we have people from those areas who were born primarily in America coming into Louisiana and then coming to Congo Square, the music changes. The dance changes, the musical instruments are altered. We see a difference in the reports that we get from travelers, from the newspaper articles. We see that reflected in Congo Square. There were also people who gathered at Congo Square who had originated or who had resided or originated in Haiti and Cuba and other parts of the Caribbean. We look to historical events for those rationales, for the reasonings. And the main historical event, the catalyst, was the Haitian Revolution. So we know that during the Haitian Revolution, many people fled from Haiti. Some came directly to New Orleans because of the French connection. Haiti was also a French colony, and so was New Orleans. And so some came directly, but many and the majority of them went to Cuba because of the proximity. However, in 1809, with the war breaking out between France and Spain, over 10,000 Haitian immigrants migrated to New Orleans, doubling the size of the city and greatly impacting the culture that was there. So even after 1809, we can see in reports from the from travelers and from newspaper articles and from different city council minutes, we can see the impact of the Haitian culture on New Orleans and directly in Congo Square. So many times when I looked for examples of musical instruments that I read about or examples of dances that I read about, I had to look to these locations for more information. I had to look to Haiti. I had to look to Cuba and other parts of the Caribbean. So we have those different contributions to what happened in Congo Square, as well as people who were born in New Orleans who were then speaking Creole language and who were then having been exposed to musical instruments and musical experiences from different ethnic groups. All of that ended up in Congo Square. How did it influence the music? How did it influence the dance? How did it impact the culture that we know as New Orleans, the culture that we know as jazz, right? We see the blending starting right there at those gatherings. When we think about the people, we also have to think about the different periods of time. New Orleans, of course, was French-founded, Catholic-based. All of that makes a very big difference based on the Cold War, the laws that happened there. And so during the French period, it's important to see who slave traders brought to New Orleans, because then when we see those travels accounts that mention that they saw this instrument or this dance or this, and we can say, oh, well, who was more likely to have been there? What ethnic group was more likely to have been there? So during the French period, we look at this solid bar, we see that overwhelmingly the ethnic group that slave traders brought were from the Senegambian region. And again, French-speaking region, French-colonized region. It makes sense. During the Spanish period, here again we look at the solid bar, but this time the solid bar represents people from the Central Africa, Congo, Angola region. Overwhelmingly, during the Spanish period, people who were brought enslaved people who were brought to Louisiana originated in the Senegambian region. This, by the way, is based on the research by Gwendolyn Mitlow Hall. She has done the most and profound research on ethnic African ethnicities in the Americas. And one of her groundbreaking books was Africans in Colonial Louisiana, where she actually listed all of the slave ships. There's also a slave database that she has created, and it's online, showing the people who were brought during the slave trade to New Orleans. So this is a graph that she created, she designed for me, actually. The first one that you saw is in her book, Africans in Colonial Louisiana. This one she designed so that it would be easy for my audience to see the impact. So let's look then at the American period, realizing, though, that the transatlantic slave trade officially, that is, ended in 1808. But her information, her graph shows the ethnic African ethnicities up to 1820. And she shows that although the majority of enslaved people who were brought to Louisiana originated in the Senegambian region, the overwhelming number who remained in New Orleans, the majority were of Congo-Angola heritage. So that difference is very, very important when we look at, again, the travels accounts, what they saw and what they wrote about. So the name Congo Square. That's important to know that there are two rationales that I have found for the name Congo Square. One is that it was a generic term that meant anything related to black people or of African ethnicity. Congo was a term that was used to say, oh, they're Congo dances, meaning the dances of black people. The Congo snake, the black snake. So it was used generically, but it was also used specifically to refer to the people. And the other rationale was that Congo Square was named so because the overwhelming majority of the people who gathered in Congo Square and who were in New Orleans were of Congo heritage. It was also named that way, named Congo Square because of the Congo dance. So I agree with both. I think both are valid rationales for the name Congo Square, especially when you consider the fact that there was a Congo Square in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. If you've ever been to the historic district, down from Independence Hall is what's called now Washington Square, but it was once called Congo Square for the same reason. The people who gathered there originated in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and they danced on Sundays. That became a burial ground. Same reasons that we know of Congo Square in New Orleans as a gathering place, that was a gathering place for them. And so although it's officially called Washington Square, now there is a plaque that talks about the history and the time period when it was considered Congo Square. So let's look at the practices. We've talked about the place, the people, and now the practices. These were among the traditional events that happened there. We know that there were religious beliefs celebrated, the languages. We can talk about the songs and the singing styles. We can talk about the dances, the rhythmic patterns of musical instruments, and the marketing or economic exchange. Many people overlook that when they talk about Congo Square. They say, oh, we know that's where the enslaved people gathered. And they usually don't say enslaved. They usually say slaves. But we know that they were enslaved. They were placed into that position, into that situation. And many people forget about the marketing. But at the core of the marketing were people who were enslaved as buyers. They were the buyers and the sellers because they had the opportunity on Sunday afternoons, with their owner's permission, that is, to cultivate a plot of land that they may have been given so they could sell the produce, or they had the opportunity to go and gather and hunt what they could find in the wild and sell that. They also had the opportunity to make things like pralines and challah and pies and popcorn. We have evidence that they sold these and that there was a booming market for them at Congo Square on Sunday afternoons. And so there were also free people of color who attended those gatherings, and they came with money to patronize the vendors, the market women. And there were men, but the overwhelming majority of the vendors were market women. So the economic exchange was a thriving one. And what's interesting to see is this is the weekend for Jazz Fest, the first weekend of Jazz Fest. On Sunday afternoons, when the gates, people on the way to the square, when the gates open, and when the gates close at the end of the festival, you would see people along the way selling pies, sweet potato pies. You would see them selling, pralines. Many of them sell pralines. So you see this petty marketing, and petty I mean by on the small scale, still going on around the gates of the festivals. You see them going on at second line events. Now, not only are they stationaries, but sometimes there are people with rolling carts, you know, that will follow the crowd during second line processions. But again, these petty vendors are still there marketing their wares on a small scale, but still marketing some of the same things that were marketed at Congo Square hundreds of years ago. So I'll look at some of these practices, but we won't be able to get through all of them. Let's first, though, before we look at the practices, look at this image. And This is the iconic image of Congo Square. If you've ever probably read anything or studied anything about Congo Square, this image pops up. But I like to talk about it because it is a little controversial. It's called the Bamboo. It was sketched by E.W. Kimball, who never saw Congo Square. And he based it on an article that this accompanied that was written by George Washington Cable, who we don't think ever saw Congo Square either. But it has become the authentic one, and there are some good things that we can take from it. One, we see that the musicians are sitting on the ground inside, and we do see that this first musician is sitting straddling a drum, which is very, very important and significant, and we're glad that he put it there. That really authenticates or gives some authenticity to this image. We also see that people are now in a semicircle. We know that at Congo Square for the dances, they encircle the dancers and the musicians. So in this case, the circle is open up. This is very similar to what happened on the stage when minstrels took this material to the stage. E.P. Christie was one of those minstrels. You may have heard of Christie Minstrels. Well, E.P. Christie, in his memoirs, talked about the fact that he stood at Congo Square on Sunday afternoons every chance he got. And everything that he found at Congo Square, he turned to gold. I have two different accounts from him about his observances at Congo Square. And so when he took this material to the stage, he opened up the square so that the audience could see. In true fashion, there would be no audience because everybody is a participant. There's no line between the audience and the participant in traditional African dance, and which was true at Congo Square as well. So E.P. Christie, along with E.W. Kimball, have opened up this circle for the audience to see. Let's see, what else I wanted to tell you about this. So on the stage, when E.P. Christie and other minstrels took this material to the stage, the musical instruments were taken as well. We see the banjo, we see the bones, right, in minstrel shows. We also see this kind of configuration. And when on stage, one person at a time would come to the center and dance and perform and then go back into the circle. Do you get it? Just the way the minstrel does. But in this case, E.W. Kimball has allowed us to see that one person or two people dancing, and then that person would go back into the arrangement. So we can spend more time, but let's go on. I want to share with you just a couple of the ways that we know what we know about Congo Square. And one of the ways is through travelers' accounts. They're very, very valuable because many of these people who came down to New Orleans were so amazed at the fact that enslaved people were able to gather in the open from different walks of life. You had people who were field workers, had worked in the field. We had people who were domestics who worked in the house. You had people who were hired out. That means that they were many times living as if they were free. They were rented out, so to speak. And so the owners had rented them out to places like the city of New Orleans, had rented them out to the electric companies, to the railroad company. Sometimes they had just been rented out to another person, maybe to restaurants. And these people were called hired out or rented out, but they lived as if they were free. So they would report to their owners and give some of the money, but they were able to keep some of the money for themselves. And so they were at the gatherings as well, bringing money in, again, to patronize the market women. So in this case, in 1808, Christian Schultz, who visited the gathering, said that the principal dancers or leaders are dressed in wild and savage fashions, always ornamented with a number of tails of smaller wild beasts. And those who appeared the most horrible always attracted the largest circle of company. So I want you to remember that they are dancers. They are principal dancers. What we found true in Congo Square from researching is that the dance, the music, and the songs were all one. Right, so there's a certain dance for every song, and a certain song for every dance, so to speak, and musical instruments that accompany them. So, Robert Ferris Thompson, who really studied and lived a while, not lived a while, but visited over and over again, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and researched it, found that in the Congo, ritual specialists, also called traditional diviners, wear these small tails. You can see the apron of tails. And the belief is that those tails hold special powers. They hold spirits and medicines that are used to heal and protect and to predict the future. They're used to advise. Here's another example of a diviner from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So you see that he's adorned with the tails of small animals. Here's another one on the side. You may be able to see that one. But look in the background, you also see a drummer, because this diviner is getting ready to dance. And Robert Ferris Thompson found out that when the dancers spin around, remember he's in a circle, because the report said that those are the principal dancers of the circles. The belief is that when the tails fly out, they give off medicines and powers and spirits. Remember, those spirits are to heal, right? To protect and to advise and to counsel. So you would now know from researching this, from looking at the travels account, knowing then that in 1808, large numbers of people were there from the Congo Angola region. And then someone studying this region, finding their information and putting the two together, connecting the dots, so to speak, and you would find out, yeah, it makes sense that they were in among the largest circle of people. Does it make sense? The largest people would be there to receive the healing and the spirit and the spirits that come from these diviners who are wearing these small animal tails. And this also shows us the foundation for what we call voodoo religion and belief systems in New Orleans. We have, if you were to go to Jackson Square at any time, you still see the people who are reading palms and who are giving the advice and carrying on parts of the traditions, not always authentically the way they were first brought to New Orleans, but you see the variations, offshoots of that. So let's also look then at the musical instruments. And there are other examples of religious practices, but I just want to share briefly some of them with you. All right, so musical instruments. Christian Schultz, who also, this is the same person who we just talked about, said that they have their own national music consisting of, for the most part, of a long kind of narrow drum of various sizes, from 2 to 8 feet in length, 3 or 4 of which make a band. So within those circles, he's saying, there was more than one drum. But there were also more than one kind of instrument. And you saw that in the sketch that E.P. Christie made that we saw earlier. Sitting on the ground, there were several drummers. But I pointed out to you the drummer who straddled his drum. James Creasy then, this is in 1808, Christian Schultz. So James Creasy saw the gathering in 1834 and wrote about it. He says that groups of 50s and 100s may be seen in different sections of the square with banjos, tom-toms, violins, jawbones, triangles, and various other instruments. So do we see just African-based instruments in 1834, or do we see European-derived instruments as well? We see the violin, European instrument. We see the triangles, European-based instruments. So look at the difference of years, 1808, 1834. Almost 30 years later, we are beginning to see European instruments coming into the gatherings and being a part of the mix at Congo Square. At the same time, we'll see the dances coming in too. We'll see songs coming in from different areas. And we begin to see the blend of how these the different cultural practices were blended to create new music, right? Creolized forms of music at Congo Square. This sketch is very, very valuable to us. This is from Benjamin Latrobe, who saw the gatherings in 1819. And he wrote a very long narrative about what he saw, and in addition to sketching these musical instruments. He saw the gatherings in February of 1819. So in his narrative, he said there were 500 to 600 gatherers. Many people like to say, oh, that was the max. But I don't think they've considered the fact that that was February, you know, in New Orleans, probably our coldest year. And considering the fact that many people were poorly clad, many of them did not have shoes, their clothing clothing may have been torn. So I know that the gatherings were larger in the springtime and in the summertime. And by the way, they did not happen every Sunday. This is one misconception that people have, especially in New Orleans, that they were out there every Sunday. If there was a rumor of an uprising or an uprising, the gatherings were possibly shut down. At least the city officials revisited the fact whether or not the gatherings would continue. One example was in 1811, after the 1811 revolt. Some people call it the German Coast Uprising, some people's slave revolt of 1811, but it was the largest revolt in the history of U.S. And during that time, approximately 500 people, enslaved people, revolted and marched from the German coast down to New Orleans. The city council within 7 days met to assess whether or not these gatherings at Congress Square could continue. And with some modifications, they agreed that they should continue because the idea was that there are laws already in place to control this. If people just follow the laws, we would be okay. But in other parishes, this is what we call counties in Louisiana, in other parishes, the gatherings were shut down, where they were discontinued because of that 1811 revolt. So if there was any rumor of a revolt, or if there were changes in the administration, changes in the overall administration from the French to the Spanish to the American, these laws were visited and opportunities for enslaved people to gather were reassessed. So in 1819, Benjamin Latrobe entered the gatherings, but not only did he come to the gatherings and stand on the outside of those circles as a spectator, which is what most people did, Benjamin Latrobe entered those circles. And you think about it, you know, him entering the circles, was that the right thing? Was that a good thing? Was that a bad thing? Are you happy about it? Are you sad about it? So that is a discussion question within itself. But as a historian, I'm really glad that he did. As a African-American, I'm really like, you know, those were sacred spaces, maybe, probably he shouldn't have. But we have these as a result. We have the banza, which is the forerunner of the banjo, the gourd background. And we have this figure at the top, which we could really talk about a long, long time. There are people who, including Robert Ferris Thompson, who've studied Congo Angola heritage, and they say that this stance is very, very important because there's nothing crossed on this person. Everything is open, which allows the spirits to come in and out. It reminds me of the ring shout, if any people here are familiar with studying the ring shout from the Carolinas. When people shuffle around those circles, they did not cross their legs. Nothing was crossed on them because, again, it allows the spirits to come in and out and freely because it's a religious and spiritual dance. So then we have drums. Here again is a man straddling the drum. Very, very important because this connects us directly to the Congo-Angola region, and it connects us to Congo culture throughout the diaspora. We see this, the practice of sitting on the drum in Bomba. In Puerto Rico, we see a Kamina. In Jamaica, we see it in the Congo. We see it in Haiti, all over. Then there is another drum, and a third drum at the bottom. When I first started looking at this, I was able, fortunately, to connect with an ethnomusicologist from the Congo-Angola region. And when I sent the images to him, he says, I'm familiar with all of those. All of those instruments are familiar to me from my homeland. And since then, I've talked to more and more people from the Congo-Angola region, particularly dancers and musicians, who also talk about these instruments and tell me what the significance of them. And although some of them may not be sketched exactly, but they were able to identify the majority, especially these drums, and tell me about them. So before I go on, I want to show you an example of a person playing this drum, because Alan Lomax, who conducted a lot of the interviews during the WPA period, Works Progress Administration, not only interviewed people in New Orleans and in the United States throughout the South, he also went to Haiti. Remember earlier I said sometimes I had to look to Haiti and to Cuba to get information about what I found in Congo Square. And fortunately, Alan Lomax went to Haiti in 1836-1837, and he videotaped a man sitting on a drum playing it in this. We could go on. I know you want to see the rest of it, don't you? I love it. You can never get enough of seeing it and studying it. So this is a great, great resource for dancers as well as musicians who are studying that. But in addition to having the sketch, from Congo Square. We'll also have a narrative from a person who was interviewed. Who talked about this type of drumming. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about this one. So he told me, he said, it's a drum. I said, a drum? How is it played? He said, the musician sits on the ground, and he places one toe underneath the head from underneath, and on the top he plays with his hands, but then he moves the toe back and forth. Same principle as the drummer we saw from Haiti, right? Changing the pitch of the drum. Okay, let's go on. We have to go. So here's the drummer. So the Juba dance is one of the dances that was observed in Congo Square. And this came from James Thomas, who saw the dances in the 1840s. Actually, James Thomas had been to New Orleans, had been brought there as an enslaved person. And this time, he comes back as a businessman. And Robert Ferris Thompson found out that this drum comes from a Kikongo word, well, this dance comes from a Kikongo word as well as a verb meaning zuba, which means to slap. Very, very important. So here we have the influence, the carryover. We have hambone, we have slapping juba. The influence also extends to Greek show steppers, college students who step in Greek show. This other dance, the Congo dance, very, very popular. It was the most written about dance during the American period. And there are lots of narratives about it, lots of eyewitness reports. Timothy Flint also saw people dancing the Congo dance in the streets of New Orleans. This dance is related very closely to the second line dance when it was seen by some of the, by Benjamin Latrobe particularly. He saw women with handkerchiefs dancing around the insides of one of those circles that he entered. Remember I said he entered the circles. The Bambula dance. This is one of the earliest references to the Bambula dance. It was 1786. And one of the bishops complained about people dancing the bambula before the end of services. Remember I said on Sundays, enslaved people were able to enjoy the Sundays as holy days, but in the afternoons they could come and dance. Well, in this case, they were dancing before the afternoons, before they were able to, were allowed to do so. And he responds by using the word tangos, which is one of the earliest references to the word tangos. And important when you think about tangos and habanera and the bambula dance, the Congo dance, all those are connected. I want to move as quickly as I can to this passage by Alice Nelson Dunbar, who says that those people who know the tune of the Congo dance, which every child in New Orleans could sing, if the Congo dance, the tune was that popular, it was, I don't know what would be popular here in Germany, but in New Orleans or Louisiana it would be like Mary Had a Little Lamb, something that everybody sings. And I even have an interview from the WPA period that talks about the popularity of the Congo dance and how it was one of the dances of Congo Square. This is a tune, one of the Creole slave songs that was used to accompany that dance. But at the very beginning is the habanera rhythm. Can you clap that with me? And stop. All right, so that rhythmic pattern is important to us in New Orleans because, you know, if they were singing this song, dancing a dance in Congo Square, was this the only rhythmic pattern going on? No. Polyrhythms, right? Call and response. All of those characteristics that we know of jazz were very present in Congo Square. And so one of the variations is a three-part rhythm that people in Latin America call the tresillo, right? But it has now become the basis of New Orleans music, indigenous music. We call it the second line beat. We call it the bambula beat. We call it the parade beat, the street beat. We even call it the New Orleans beat because it's just that primary to New Orleans music. And so it goes like this. Can you clap that with me? Okay, so then I was going to play the melody for you so that you could see how this Creole slave song was appropriated. 5 minutes? I have time then. Yes, okay, good. All right, so let's play the melody. This piece, we could have a whole session just on this one piece, but let me just play. So, many of those songs, this one included, came from Haiti. Remember I said I had to look back to Haiti and Cuba when I studied studied Congo Square. So then one of the families that migrated during the Haitian Revolution was Louis Gottschalk's family. And with him, with them came Sally, the nurse. Babysitter in our turn, but nurse. And Sally sang these songs for Gottschalk's, for the families. As a matter of fact, this piece was written by Gottschalk's sister, the piano accompaniment. She wrote a series of 12 of these Creole slave songs, and she said in the beginning that these were the songs that rocked generations of children to sleep. This is how, and this is the interview that was given, we don't have time for, was given by a person of European heritage because she said, they sang it all around me. I know this song. I know it in and out. All right, so let's go on. I want you to then hear how Louis Gottschalk used that melody, and he used several others as well, for his world-famous piece, Bambula. Do you hear it? Are you able to hear the melody? So then, 60 years later, Samuel Coleridge Taylor also treated the melody, but what he did was significant. He placed the melody line at the top, and he placed the origin. He says the West Indies. Do you see that at the very top? So he gave credit to the location for this melody, the West Indies, and we know that it came from Haiti. So let's listen to the way Samuel Coleridge Taylor treated this same melody. Are you able to hear it? And we can go on, but I know that we want to. I want to stop so that we can. I can take questions from you. Basically, the practices, and I had a whole list of them. I got through as many as I could. Were once marginalized, but they are now mainstream when you think of New Orleans culture and culture around the world because we see the elements that became what we know as jazz music. We know that the music of Mardi Gras Indians, and I do have one piece, if we can play it very quickly, because then you can see the tresillo, the second line beat, the bambula beat, and how important it is to New Orleans music. I know, it's hard to stop, but I'll stop. And I'll take your questions. Thank you. All right.
Yes, two questions, actually.
Yes.
The first is Congo Square. I had thought that the majority of the slaves came from West Africa.
West and West Central Africa.
Okay, also yes. Central Africa.
Yes. Actually, the majority of them who were brought to Louisiana originated in the Senegambian region, but the majority that stayed in New Orleans came from Congo-Angola region.
Okay.
Yes, so that's a distinction that we have to make.
And another interesting anecdote I came across some years ago on a liner notes of a Scott Joplin album was that he learned piano from a pupil of Brahms.
Who learned it?
Scott Joplin learned piano from a pupil of Brahms. And Brahms is, of course, a famous composer, but he never gave lessons. But he had a brother who lived for some time in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So this may be, do you know anything about this? Have you ever heard about it?
No, I haven't read anything about Scott Joplin's music. Other than that, it did have a lot of habanera and a lot of those different rhythmic patterns in it.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
I'm glad you mentioned something about Scott Joplin because it goes back to your discussion about the banjo mm-hmm. being of African origin. And actually, it was Scott Joplin's mother who was a banjoist. And although he may have studied classical music, but it was the banjo rhythms that had a major impact on ragtime. So I thought I would mention to see how the circle keeps going from Africa back to the Americas. By way of the banjo.
Thank you.
As you mentioned.
Good, thank you. And the habanero rhythmic pattern is very, very important. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh, could you speak briefly on Code Noir and how effective it was? And describe what it is, maybe a mm-hmm. little bit more, I think, for our audience, but yeah. Also leading into the next group, the panel, how effective was the Code Noir?
So the Code Noir was a set of laws. They were called articles. And they were first passed or implemented in Haiti, Saint-Domingue, at that time. And then in 1724, of course, they were adopted by Louisiana because the same laws, same religion, you know, same colonizers were in both locations. And they were basically were to dictate how enslaved people were to be managed or were to be ruled. And like I said, the one that we think about mostly when we were talking about Congo Square or about rhythms or about music was the fact that Sundays were holy days and they were off days. They were, I don't want to use the word free because they were not free, but they were work free. That's the word, work free days. And actually anybody who was found working was supposed to be confiscated from their owners. So if they were to work, many times they were paid. But again, the implementation was based on the owner's generosity, so to speak. So there were some owners, of course, who didn't buy by the law, but many of them did. And so many of them paid their enslaved people or gave them that day without work on Sundays. And then the other article was that church was supposed to be observed. It was a holy day. Is that enough? Yes. All right, thank you.
Hi, Freddie.
Yes.
Just a question about one of the slides you had, I think you said it was the first sketch, you know, where they're kind of in a circle.
Yes, E.B.
The dancer.
E.W. Kimball.
And you talked about the religious aspects of the dance, mm-hmm. the performance, you know, the fetishes or whatever, you know.
So you're talking about the people who address the diviners?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah. But my question was, you know, at what point, and, you know, could you describe the ways that the dances and the music and the performance and so on become less religious and more secular?
Mm.
You know, is that what happens in Congo Square during that?
Well, it changes. I won't say it becomes more circular, but one thing that I can think of to answer your question is that we don't have voices from inside the circle. Do you know what I mean? So all of our voices, all of our accounts are coming from people who are spectators, who are onlookers. And so many people who say, oh, they were not doing voodoo, they were not doing that, well, they were not the followers of voodoo. And the followers of voodoo were saying, no, we didn't do that in the public. But the people who, the people who were not followers of voodoo saying, yeah, we saw them out there, they were doing that, they were carrying on their ceremonies. The people who were followers of voodooists were saying, no, we didn't do that in public. So this is by chance one of the best ones that we have to show that there were actual African traditions carried on. So we don't really have voices from inside the circle telling us, you know, yes, this happened, no, this didn't happen. We were not doing this. We have to put it all together. Does that make sense? So whether they were carrying on these ceremonies less over time, we don't know. We don't have reports to show. Yes? Everything. So I have a timeline in the back of my book, but you can see there are a lot of holes, a lot of gaps in it, because I'm not going to fill in information that I don't have. But every account that I have, I place on those timelines so people could see exactly what was going on. And as far as I know, I don't have a linear, consistent account of what was going on religiously or spirituality. Does that make sense? Okay, great. Thank you.
Hi, Prof. I would like to thank you for your work, your research, which is really amazing. And I'm very, how can I say that? I'm full of praise because there's something about the culture which comes from the Bakongo, both in that region, Angola, Congo-Brazzaville, Kinshasa, which yes. is not secretive, but it's very difficult to penetrate. And when you go to Cuba, with the Palo Monte, Palo Mayombe, it's the same. There's one scholar, Prof. Barbaro, who has managed to, because maybe he's an insider, or the painter Bedia, because he's an insider, he's able to give certain element. But I was very surprised when a few years ago I bumped into a jazz musician who belongs to a fraternity in New Orleans, which is akin to the Congo culture. And what I found very interesting is also him, it was very difficult to... They just don't give informations. And I'm very, I have a question. While, let's say, it's very interesting to see how much information we have on the, let's say, the Yoruba-speaking people in in Brazil, or Cuba, you know, we have a lot of information culturally available, and scholarly we can push very forward. But in terms of the Bakongo, how can we really make that knowledge, you know, readily available? Because I think that in this 21st century, the influence mm-hmm. in every realm, yeah. philosophy, music, it's very important. But how do you, from your experience, how in terms of scholarly mm-hmm. work, what do you think we need to do in order to make that culture available? And the last question is that person, the jazz musician, when he asked me about the contemporary music from the Congo, I mentioned to him if you go in Belgium, there's that label called Cram Record, and they have a Congotronic. Mm-hmm. But these are the Bakongo people who used to play music for weddings, funerals. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the folklore. But it was, he recognized beats, but mm-hmm. it was difficult to straddle the bridge, because ultimately that's what is important, both mm-hmm. the diaspora and Africa, to work together toward, yes. you know, the reconciliation. What do you think we, and are you positive about how far we have gone from back in the days to where we still need to go? Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. You mentioned the answer. You said work together. We need to collaborate. So I need to work with a scholar from the Congo-Angola region and bring what I know and what I have found in the records about Congo Square to that person. And we say, oh, this, and he helps or she helps interpret, which is what Robert Ferris Thompson did. He's the scholar who's done the most as far as going to try and bridge those gaps and to try and see. But we need more people to do that, to collaborate, to work together. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for your presentation. I'd be interested in hearing your take and your opinion on the connection between this African heritage and traditions with two other very distinctive Southwest Louisiana styles, which are Zydeco music and also bounce music. How do you see the connection with the African traditions in those two very distinctive New Orleans or Southwest Louisiana styles?
Yes, so there are connections. Do you remember the quote from Creasy who said the violins, the jawbone? Do you remember seeing the jawbone among those instruments? Yes, and so it's a scraping technique. And we know that that was very prevalent among people from the Congo-Angola region. And we see that carryover with the jawbone and now, not the jawbone in Zydeco, but the what? The washboard, yeah. So there are some musical connections that we can see. We can also see when we look at the Cajun and the Zydeco, which is sort of related, we see some musical carryovers like the Kalenda dance, which was brought to or that came to the Louisiana area with enslaved people. Well, now that is a part of folklore among the Cajun people, the Danse de Kalenda. So you see a lot of carryovers in different ways, yes? The steps and the dance. And then the rhythmic patterns are definitely there for the other musical style that you mentioned. I forgot already. But in my mind, I knew it would be rhythm. The bounce, yes, the bounce. Big Frida, yes. And the call and response. So you see a lot of those characteristics that are prevalent in all indigenous New Orleans music, but carried over in the bounce music. Thank you. Thank you very much.